Good evening. Every now and then, it's happened to a couple of times before, at least, in the Brattleboro Zen Center's history, that I've gotten the urge, oh, thinking maybe I should talk about karma. That's a good topic. And then I realized that maybe it's not. It's much too complex a topic that so easily lends itself to easy to get caught intellectually, and to try to make sense of everything that happens, so to sort of push everything through the lens of teachings of karma somehow, and get caught in sort of the realm of karma, the karma of karma. Supposedly, somewhere in the Buddhist teachings, there's a list of five things that can make one crazy, and trying to understand karma is supposedly on that list. So usually, in the past, I thought I better not. But tonight, my judgment, I don't know, I failed. So I've been studying this because it's a fascinating topic and central in Buddhist teachings, and I've been sort of engaged in studying it. And against my better judgment, we'll try to say a few words tonight. And part of why I'm drawn to this is just how the Buddha took this concept, which existed already in his time, of karma, which was, as it was used before by, it was sort of the Vedic tradition, Brahmanical tradition, rather. Good karma was something that was generated by turning to the Vedic priests. And they would make a sacrifice, an animal sacrifice, usually a horse, understand, on one's, or rather one's family's behalf. So that was a way to ritually sort of appeal to the gods for good fortune. And they didn't have an ethical dimension. The fundamental relationship was with the gods. And so the Buddha, part of what he took was this same concept, same phrase. He used it to point to the importance of relationship between human beings and between me and myself as well. And really, the whole world. In doing so, he really highlighted ethics as a central importance to the spiritual life, and sort of bringing the spiritual life from the God realm into the everyday life. The Jains were kind of, arising. I can't remember the name of the founder of Jainism, but he's in the Buddhist, the Pali Canon, sort of a contemporary with the Buddha. And they developed more of an ethical understanding of karma as well. However, it differed in that it was about the outcome of one's actions that determined the karma. And for the Buddha, the ethical quality, really the fundamental part was the impulse behind an action, determine whether it was good or bad. So this term chetana in Sanskrit, intention or volition, was fundamental. And I think this right here says a lot about the Buddhist path of awakening. That first of all, it is fundamentally ethical. What we do and how we act in our everyday lives matters. Our lives give us opportunities to conduct ourselves ethically and to abstain from acting unethically when tempted to. And this deportment shapes us as human beings. and shapes what we're ways in which we're prone to act in the future. Secondly, to carry out this practice of ethics, it challenges us to focus our attention not just on what we're doing, but how we're doing it and with what kind of mind we're carrying out an action. So to really study our mental state. And so in this way, Buddhism is fundamentally psychological and introspective. Familiar with Dogen's phrase, or to study the Buddha way is to study the self, chanted a few weeks ago. And so, as I've mentioned, yeah, these teachings are incredibly complex, and it's very easy to fall into sort of a mechanical, mathematical mindset and to try to make sense of it all. Why does this happen? What does, you know? And to always look at karma, which is just one of the ways of causation in Buddhism. There's rarely just karma that's acting upon any situation. And so it's fine to geek out on some of the nuances of karma, and we may be asking those questions of, like, why and how do we understand this in terms of karma, just to assure ourselves that Buddhism aligns with our deeply held beliefs about justice. And the Buddha's primary concern was not with philosophical understanding, but with practice. And his whole point with teaching karma was really to encourage us to practice generosity, ethical conduct, take responsibility for our deportment, and encourage us to live in accordance with the nature of reality, the Dharma, in accordance with our fundamental non-separateness from everything around us. So, from the perspective of interbeing with each and every one, every other person, blade of grass, speck of dust, when we hurt others, we hurt ourselves. And this is the path to reckon with our suffering and to take care not to repeat the same old mistakes. And when we repeat the same old mistakes, because karma tends to lead us down the same paths again and again. Though it's not deterministic, but when we recognize our mistakes, we can avow them, regret, and move on. Karma, term really means action, and it is about what we do with our bodies, our speech, and our minds. So that's my concern tonight. So according to the teachings, understanding and improving one's karma or action helps one to this sort of three outcomes that are traditionally listed, is to live more happily in the present life. It lays the groundwork for the cultivation of concentration and wisdom. And one can attain a more favorable rebirth with more opportunities for spiritual development. So, in the Buddha's time, there was a strong belief in rebirth. This is not something he introduced. That was there, and he did not counter it. So, as Westerners, we may be less convinced the doctrine of rebirth. But even so, even in the early texts, when the Buddha teaches on rebirth, it's also appears to include, like, the fact that we're really reborn moment to moment and constantly changing in our lives here. So there's a way to read rebirth as you know, without needing to literally believe in reincarnation, but it still makes sense that sort of where we can cultivate our own fortune in this life by acting virtuously, by abstaining from acting unwholesomely. Oh. In the confession and repentance verse, which we don't chant here so often, but traditionally it's chanted every day in Zen training temples, goes, "All my ancient twisted karma," acknowledging your karma, "from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion." So these are the three fundamental roots of unwholesome karma: this greed, hate, and delusion. And this also points to the, like, that it's the intention behind the action. If our action is driven by greed, hate, and delusion, it's unwholesome. If it's driven by the absence of these, the positive qualities, it's wholesome. Next line is, "born through body, speech, and mind." So, an action isn't limited to what I do physically and what I express verbally, but also how I think. So even again, if it makes sense from the standpoint of intention, right? That you can have an intention and without carrying it out in an actual physical verbal action, but if you're dwelling on it, it still creates unwholesome karma. And the last line is, "I now fully avow." So, knowing that we are influenced by our past karma, we're wholeheartedly, sincerely avow it, and set the aspiration to live a different life. As it said, sentient beings are those who are driven by karma, and bodhisattvas are those who are guided by vow. So within this chant, and there's you know, other ways to do this, like informally, but which has sort of these components as well. The way to reckon with the painful results of previous unwholesome actions is like three steps, really. The first is to be, we got to be willing to admit that we did something harmful, and that, you know, perhaps it was an unwholesome intention that we weren't quite catching, but may have been guiding it. And to be humble enough to acknowledge that we have such karma that not all our intentions are wholesome, but unless we're Buddhas, we some unwholesome intentions will arise in our consciousness, and have the patience and compassion with ourselves to accept that. It's important. So as long as we have a belief in a false separate self, we're prone to having unwholesome impulses. So this is really the confession piece, and avowal. And then based on that, we may open and feel some really regret for our actions, past action, which is repentance, which sounds harsh, but it's really just about experience of regret. So this is, you know, a way to really purify karma. And then the third one is based on this sort of acknowledgement, the feeling of regret, we can resolve to refrain from such actions in the future, do the best we can. And so if regret for past harm is sincere, then resolve for future non-harm follows. So we can learn from our mistakes. As Japanese ancestor Dogen quotes an old saying, saying, if you fall on the ground, you stand by using the ground to get up. You can't stand up without a ground. So this is the way to relate to our mistakes. We use them to stand back up and make our best effort, and then we fall down again. One continuous mistakes is the path of a Zen master, supposedly, at least one continuous mistake. So how much more for us? So, and then we go on, right? There is also a warning in these teachings that to sort of to dwell on and entertain heavy guilt feelings is considered a form of self-hatred, and it's an anguish state that will obstruct calm and clarity and really spiritual developments. So we sincerely regret, you know, acknowledge sincerely regret and sort of set an intention to do our best going forward, and then we go on. Nothing more, nothing less. When it comes to wholesome, beneficial karma, it's also often referred to as merit. I think I may have included the word merit just in our dedication that Aaron chanted. Positive energy, sometimes we say it. Kokyo Henkel, he describes merit as increased open-heartedness in the person who did the action. So I really like this way of understanding merit, because it takes it away from this kind of mathematical, but into the heart. And in the Mahayana teachings, the complete culmination of open-heartedness, emotional open-heartedness, is considered an essential condition for someone to wake up. And together with the culmination of wisdom or non-conceptual understanding of emptiness. So these two go together. And merit is central in our practice. So I really like this term open-heartedness a lot. I think because it also helps us to move from this intellectual understanding, which I already said, but it really gets at the non-dual relationship between cause and effect, between our intention for carrying out an action and the karmic fruit. Very simply put, if we act sincerely with open-heartedness, we cultivate open-heartedness. And this open-heartedness allows us to, so the three before, live more happily in the present life. With an open heart, we can expect to experience more joy, right? It lays the groundwork for cultivation of concentration and wisdom. We need an open heart to come to a non-conceptual understanding of the nature of reality. Because when we operate with an open heart, we're already kind of beginning to live in accordance with our non-separateness from the world around us. We're sort of loosening up our sense of separate self by opening up our hearts. And then, obviously, we attain a more favorable rebirth. The next life, or moment by moment. So an open heart brings its own fortunes with it. We're more open to opportunities, certain opportunities coming our ways, if our heart has been opened. This is what I think. Try Traditionally, there are three bases for affecting karmic fruitfulness or merit. Yeah, this gets added on later, but I think the sort of the first three, or the primary three, is giving, ethical discipline, and meditative cultivation of wholesome qualities. So, ethics, already talked about. It's how fundamental this is in many ways. The distinguishment between wholesome and unwholesome intentions. And so, to act with the absence of greed, hate, and delusion is to generate good merit. It's interesting, I think, that meditative cultivation of wholesome qualities is on this list. And it makes some sense if karma is understood as intention. This seems like important work, right? To cultivate positive mental qualities. It can also, to when we settle and become a little more concentrated, it offers some protection from afflictive emotions to arise. And then giving, to say a few words about that, is the first one listed. So, also because I think it's a clear example of how to move from how to open one's heart, really. Traditionally, the Buddhist monastic sangha is to consider the best field of merit, which is convenient because they're also trying to reach, solicit alms to support themselves. But supposedly, it matters, like the more virtuous the recipient of a gift, the more the greater the merit. And so, I'd like to think that the Buddhist monks and nuns are very living, ethically upright lives. I think it's also mentioned there because it's kind of the most immediate place to practice giving, practice open-heartedness, to move from a concern with me to a concern to we, or to the group, just by giving generously. And this is traditionally Buddhist sanghas operate with a gift economy, right? Which we do as well. And so, from the perspective of a separate self, giving when we're not required to makes no sense, right? It just means less for me. And when we're operate in the transactional economy, there's little opportunity for generating merit, right? We're just meeting the expectation. Like, if we don't meet that, then we're kind of stealing. So there's potential for negative karma, but there's not the same space for generating merit in a transactional economy. But so, once it's a gift economy, any gift has merit, right? And it's less about the size of what's given, but it's about the intention, which determines the karmic effect, the giving. And supposedly, any act of giving is seen as karmically fruitful, even if we're giving with some hope of return, or giving like purely to get the karmic result of giving. It still has merit, but it's say that it leaks. And I found this interesting, and I read this before, but giving that's motivated, on the other hand, by the calm and the joy that giving naturally gives is considered sort of to generate more merit than giving maybe merely for the sake of accumulation of merit. So there's still an expectation of an outcome for the self in some ways, but that outcome is peace and joy, which again makes sense. Think about merit as open-heartedness, right? If we're giving out of the sense of the karma, generating merit, then it's kind of this calculating, this is a separate self, just like trying to get more. It's sort of transactional. But to give out of the calm and joy that comes from giving is to really allow one's heart to be opened by the act of giving. And so this is, of course, what we do in our services. We take any positive energy, merit that we've generated through our sitting and our chanting, traditional practices for generating merit, and then we give that merit away. It's not about accumulating, it's about giving it away. It's about practicing open-heartedness. And of course, by practicing open-heartedness, you generate open-heartedness. So it's a mindset of abundance, this way. Of course, we have in Zen, that's a fairly central story of the tradition. Zen is when our first Chinese ancestor, Bodhidharma, said to have met the Chinese Emperor Wu, who was in the history of Buddhism in China. It really varied throughout history, whether there was sometimes there was a lot of support from political leaders, sometimes there was a lot of persecution. Emperor Wu was really great support for the Buddhist Sangha and building monasteries and supporting translation and copies of sutras and so forth. And so, supposedly, so the story goes, he met with Bodhidharma shortly after Bodhidharma had arrived in China from India. This red-haired barbarian. And so Emperor Wu said, I've built all these monasteries for monks to ordain and train, had sutras copied and commissioned Buddhist images. How much merit have I earned? And Bodhidharma said, no merit. Emperor was perplexed and said, so what is the highest meaning of the holy truth? I think in this case it's the truth of relative and ultimate, the two truths. And Bodhidharma responded, nothing holy, only emptiness. And then Emperor said, who's standing before me? Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. And the Emperor was perplexed, and Bodhidharma left. Crossed the Yangtze River and sat facing the wall for 9 years, supposedly. The story goes on. For the purposes of tonight, I'm bringing up this is really that what Bodhidharma is doing, I think, is just poking at the emperor's. Emperor already knows the answer. He's been doing all this good. He's generated great wealth of merit. But it's not about, don't make it about yourself, because you're losing it this way. It's leaking. So he's really bringing in, just challenging and bringing in the emptiness, the ultimate truth. And it's like it's not about being a good person in the end. Like we should all practice and be good people, but the end result is not to become quote good people with lots of merit. That we've generated. It's to really to study the self is to forget the self, right? To get over ourselves. Doing good is absolutely fundamental for this, and we should not stop there. So that's our challenge. Nothing more, nothing less. Yeah. Thank you very much.